Telecast.
Hi, I'm Justin Crosby, and welcome to the final episode of this season of Telecast. On this week's show, I'm looking to the future of VR and immersive entertainment with Breege Whitehead, founder and creative director at Whitespark Pictures, Tom Bowers, founder of Hypothesis Media, and Nina Diamond, executive producer at New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's all coming up right now on this week's Telecast. My first guest on this week's show is Breege Whitehead, founder and creative director at Whitespark Pictures from Australia. Breege, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, and I'm really impressed in this environment we're sat in right now. It's a bit of a first for Telecast, but we're in the Royal Institution in Mayfair in London, which is a very ancient scientific establishment focusing on the communication of science and the promotion of science as a subject, really. And we're here to witness your Beyond the Milky Way VR film, which is narrated by Brian Cox. I've had the opportunity to see it. It's fantastic. Really, really enjoyable. The first VR project that I've really sort of sat down and enjoyed as part of an audience. First of all, Breege, tell us a little bit about Beyond the Milky Way and how that came about, taking us right back to the beginning.
Beyond the Milky Way is a 27-minute virtual reality documentary. It's the next closest thing to actually being there, boots on the ground, out in the Australian outback in an area called the Murchison region of Western Australia, which is spectacular country. And it goes into the future SKA telescopes, the Australian site of which will be 75 kilometres end-to-end. It's the largest radio telescope ever built. And probably the most fun fact that I like to throw out there is once built, it's going to be the best chance at finding life out in the universe. We've never built anything like this in human history. It's one of the largest scientific endeavours ever undertaken in our whole history. And it's this incredible look at what radio astronomy is, what they're building, the amazing science that's already happening out there, like finding brand new galaxies, and not just, you know, a couple, it's in the quantity of, you know, 70 million new galaxies that they're discovering out there, and really dives into some of those age-old questions that we have, you know, does life exist? When were the first stars and galaxies, you know, first switched on? And also the indigenous point of view from, you know, they're the oldest living culture in the world and the oldest astronomers in the world. They've been using the land and sky for 60 plus thousand years. So it's this incredible intersection of this amazing old history and culture combined with new technology.
My understanding of it is that it's radio waves that actually can see through the Milky Way, you know, millions of light years away to discover actually what was happening at the beginning of the universe and discovering all these new galaxies.
Yeah, so it's literally building a time machine, and you can say that with complete confidence. It's going to be able to see back all the way back to the Big Bang, which is not something that's ever been achievable before to this level of scrutiny. The SKA Low, which is being built in Australia, that's low radio frequency. So it can see through well past beyond the Milky Way into all of these other stars and galaxies and systems out there, right back to the beginning of time itself.
As part of your film, which is about half an hour long, isn't it? There's a huge supercomputer that's been built as well to process all the data that is being collected by this telescope. So it's quite a remarkable scientific project.
The off-spins of this technology are going to be incredible. They'll all end up in our phones one day. But we use that to stitch most of the footage for our film because our film's footage in turn was just so gigantic. So it was an awesome case study.
Tell us about the backers and the funding for such a project, because obviously it's niche, it's adventurous, it's breaking new boundaries in terms of technology and production. Tell us a bit about how it came about and who funded it and how it is commercially viable to create a 30-minute VR film.
Yeah, so probably have to start with our previous VR film, which is called The Antarctica Experience. And that is actually one of the, it ranks in the top 10 of highest grossing theatrical documentaries in Australia of all time. It's done extraordinarily well commercially. It's had over 1.7 million in Australian ticket sales. And that very much paved the way for this film and a lot of the distribution and a lot of the funding that we could then bring on for a project like this. So it had started, as did this film, with the West Australian Museum, which is an incredible facility in WA, in Perth, where I am based. And then our other partners that came on after that to showcase the film, it was all around Australia, internationally, New Zealand, and we had COVID hit, and we're kind of picking back up again on the other side of COVID. Relatively short amount of screens for such a big footprint and huge visitation numbers, which is just something that hasn't really been seen in VR all that much, and also an interesting business case for cinemas as well, which, you know, looking at bringing audiences back and finding new ways to get people in. Barbie Oppenheimer obviously has done really well on the weekend, but this is something else that's quite commercial. But ultimately, the audience experience is always at the heart of everything we're doing. We're making an experience that's the next best thing to being there, but also a natural history documentary. Antarctica did extremely well and paved the way for a lot of new pathways to audience, where we've then been able to establish new VR cinemas in a lot of these locations. And our partners have seen that. We've been able to show that level of interest, and we've had huge success now with this being our second film.
For any producers that are wanting to get into this space and thinking about the commercial viability, I mean, you've proven the financial case for a successful distribution of VR films. So going back to what you said a little bit about museums, so essentially you create the film with or without the participation of a museum. Let's assume it's without. And then when you're looking to distribute it, it's actually a theatrical distribution. You're approaching museums to create a VR space within their environment, so actually they can then use this as an additional attraction to their environment, and it's a paid attraction as well. And so there's a revenue share model there. Is that generally how it works?
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't have to be museums. They've been a complete natural fit for our content, but we can plug into any system anywhere in the world. So it can be cinemas, malls. We've had lots of pop-ups. We've done festivals. We've done shopping centres, done a short stint at a visitor centre, and obviously schools, hospitals. There's been all sorts of other pathways as well. It's just been that these have been our largest pathways to audience.
When we're here in the Royal Institution, your Beyond the Milky Way film has just opened today. And I think you're currently in the third showing, is it, right now, that we're talking? And how's it going?
Very well. We've had lots of sellout sessions today. It's day one. Everyone's reporting really amazing feedback so far, which is fantastic.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised because it is fantastic. And if you're listening to this and in London and you want to take your kids to see something and just pop in, it's really worthwhile. Let's talk a little bit about the production then. You obviously learnt a lot when you were producing the Antarctica film. So for producers wanting to get into this new type of filmmaking, what are the key lessons that you learned? I mean, obviously, you're using different cameras and you're using different editing techniques, and it sounds like you needed a lot of processing power, as you said, to edit the content. Just explain to us a little bit about the challenges and the opportunities with using 360 filming technology and how you actually come to edit that and film that and what equipment do you need, etc.
Yes, well, as a filmmaker, I find it really thrilling, actually, because you've got so much more space to play within. It's very similar in many techniques as regular television, which is also what we do. But in this case, you're directing 360 degrees, and probably some of the biggest challenges with that when you're doing it factually like we are. So we're actually deploying our cameras in real situ. We're not creating these in post-production. These are entirely shot on location with real people. So often if you're doing that in a place like Antarctica, for example, you might have this one piece of ice and the penguins are going to do what the penguins are going to do, and that's what you're going to get. And that's can be the real magic of it too. But probably one of the most important parts is sound, because you're directing your audience's attention always where you want them to be looking, because we're doing these in cinema experiences and we're doing this with 7.1 surround sound. We're not doing this at an individual level. And we work with an incredible sound designer who's based at Warner Brothers in LA, and we can place the sound down to the degree in which it falls within an audience room. So when we have, you know, a natural thing happen, like a skewer flies over, or we had a perfect double rainbow on one of the days we're filming on top of a telescope, we can use those natural things to draw people's attention, but then always bring them back around to the front. And one of the things I find most important is always directing in mind with not making people feel ill. It's 360. It's going to be a sensory overload for a lot of people in a good way. but you always want them to feel like they've got that freedom of movement within a shot. So our shots are as short as 30 seconds and as long as sometimes 90 seconds to give people the ability to drink in their environment.
And what about the implications for editing? So how do you edit? Do you edit with a VR mask actually on, or do you edit in terms of a normal sort of 2D environment in the same way that normal TV documentaries are edited?
Yeah, so we stitch all of our footage together, which is what took so long initially. So we did come back with 75 terabytes of raw footage. So that took us about 6 weeks to churn through. And then we edit it regularly like you would. We use Premiere Pro, so we put it on our edit timeline. I'll watch some things back in headset. I've got a knack for it now, so I don't feel like I need to sit there and watch the whole thing. But then it's really the online process where you're reviewing over and over again in a headset to make sure your stitch lines are perfect, that you've removed the tripod the way you want to, or you've left things in that you would like, that you're naturally looking where you want the audience to be looking.
So for somebody who's, I'm trying to get my head around I'm obviously not an editor and not a producer, but does that mean when you're talking about stitching it together, does that mean that you're looking at a one panorama, if you like?
Sometimes you can toggle as well. So you can go into 360 mode. So you're editing and knowing which way your front is facing, for example.
Right.
Yeah. And we use 360 degree cameras quite often if we've not invented them our own, because we do tend to be at that cutting edge element of technology. But in 360, you've essentially got eight cameras in one. And that's filming anywhere between 8 and 11K per camera. So although it does capture it all together, you are then essentially stitching all those eight cameras together in post-production to get that globe.
You're shooting at that sort of resolution. In terms of the headsets that are available on the market now, what resolution can you see that 11K footage on?
You can't. We deliberately shoot that level to future-proof our productions. But also for regular television, which we also do, if we're often filming these VR experiences, we're often doing complimentary TV series for them too. So we very much think of the future in that, for example, if I'm in Antarctica and I've got a 10-minute weather window to stick a camera out of a helicopter to shoot phenomenal footage that no one's ever seen before, I can put my 360-degree camera out of a helicopter and I get every single 16:9 shot that I could possibly want, and at extreme resolution. So the ability to be that nimble is really important. But in terms of VR headsets, the best that – I haven't seen it yet, but the best that looks to be coming out on the market will be the Apple headset that has got quite great resolution per eyeball. At the moment, we use VR headsets that have 2K per eyeball. But as technology evolves, we want to be ahead of the curve.
As we know, technology, that's going to ramp up quite quickly and probably quite significantly now. Apple are joining this market, which must be exciting for you. I mean, do you see the future of VR production being over and above theatrical once Apple joins the market? How do you think this market is going to build and expand?
Apple is definitely getting everyone back in the conversation again, and there's a lot of other things happening with other technology companies. So VR is thriving from a tech space, I believe. I think that where VR cinema sits is that perfect bridging gap. When we were looking at making VR content, I was not interested in making something that only a handful of people would ever see. And no discredit to festivals, they're wonderful, but they don't have a huge outreach. So I kind of looked at what is the problem that we need to solve here in terms of the industry moving forward. And I use the analogy where people did not go to having a home cinema system overnight. Everyone for decades were going out to cinemas. That's their date night. That's their family experience. And then we've evolved to have it cheaper, easier, the Netflixes of the world at home. I don't think we can just skip ahead to that in terms of VR. I think the demand and the content needs to be there first to justify why a family person would want to buy a VR headset, especially if they're going to be priced at $3,500 US like Apple's are. I mean, Apple are very much in a whole new realm of a spatial computer, so that's 360 is not going to be their main core purpose. But even the lower VR headsets around the $500 mark, you still want to be able to justify the use for that. Gaming, medical, lots of different purposes. Where I think the real amazing sweet spot is in this 360 immersive content, because you can't go to Antarctica any other way especially to some of these locations where you're living and breathing what it's like working down there. Same for the Radio Astronomy Observatory. That is a radio quiet zone. Most people will never get to go there. This is the next best thing to being able to do that. So I do think eventually we will have everyone with VR headsets in their home. I think that will naturally be how it happens, but you can't do that without a demand and without great content. And I think that's where we come in.
It was interesting when Apple did launch their new headset a few months ago, then one of the first deals they announced was a deal with Disney. So with a lot of their content and making that a 360 experience. So it's these sort of major players, once you start saying, okay, they're starting to open the market up now, and who knows, the Apple Store, you might be able to download and acquire and stream movies that you're making on there. Is that where you expect it to go?
Yeah, I do. And I thought it was very visionary when both of them announced that, and Bob Iger came out, and I can't quite remember his quote, but it was basically new ways to provide amazing, entertaining experiences for audiences. And that's exactly where this sort of content sits. It's perfect. Like, imagine if you were in the final Avengers scene and you could be doing that, and Chris Hemsworth and Chris Pratt and all the Chrises are flying around you. Like, that is where the future, I think, of entertainment will naturally go. And it's really not that hard to make that jump.
Looking to the future, you've also just announced three new 360 films. Tell us about each one of those in turn.
Yeah, so we're very excited because we believe it's a world first content deal. We've had three amazing museum partners, the WA Museum, the National Museum of Australia, and the Auckland War Memorial Museum, all put in quite a significant amount of funding, $1 million. And we will be delivering one major VR natural history experience for them for the next 3 to 5 plus years, hopefully. They've seen the benefits of our content and the amazing audience responses firsthand. And really, in order to grow and keep the longevity of this industry going, this is really what's required. So I very much am excited and applaud their vision.
They've seen the commercial benefit from working with you in the past, right? So now it's like a case of, oh, right, well, now it's time to invest into this because we can see there's a revenue stream coming for our museums in the coming years.
Yeah, and the content is just, the audience is always what drives everything. Like anything in entertainment, your audience is at the heart, and that cannot be any truer. We call it story living. It's not storytelling, because you're creating a living story that people experience. So our next three VR films are in that realm. We're doing one on the Kimberley, which, if you're not familiar with that part of Australia, it's like nowhere else on the planet. The land out there is phenomenal. It's, you know, there are dinosaur footprints you can stand and see on with your own eyes. There's a Devonian reef system that's 370 million years old, where they find fossils that still have like tissue attached to it. It's incredible. The waterfalls, the country, the culture, the people, the connection to all of that is just completely mind-blowing, and you feel a tiny speck in a very good way. We're going to try and tell that mammoth-sized story and showcase it as best as we possibly can. So, you know, we'll be taking people flying over waterfalls and taking them into the heart of these amazing ancient gorges. It's going to be incredible. Our following film, we're dubbing Journey of the Giants, which is the humpback whale migration from Australia down to Antarctica and the history of that, which also ties in with how humans have interacted with orcas and the likes.
So this is going to be 360 underwater footage.
It is, yeah, where you have humpback whales swimming above and around you. Yeah, quite remarkable and ambitious. and our last is slated to be on the Kermadec Islands, which is, if you draw a line from New Zealand to Tonga, it's pretty much in the middle in the Ring of Fire area. It's a very significant marine sanctuary, and one of only, I believe, 4 pristine classified ocean marine sanctuaries in the world. I need to fact check that, but it's amazing. It's basically like the Galapagos Islands, but for that part of the world, and teeming with so much significant life and above and again underwater.
Wow, well, those all sound fantastic, and I think they also play to a certain extent, which in a way I think Beyond the Milky Way has, care of our planet and thinking about, you know, our role in our environment, without it being a direct ecological message then, but having those experiences like being with humpback whales underwater and seeing them, I mean, it can't help you want to care for your planet more, and hopefully will encourage more and more people to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. From a personal standpoint, that's why I got into VR. I was very keen for people to experience climate change on their doorstep, and what better place to take people to see that than Antarctica? But you don't want hundreds of thousands of people going to Antarctica, and yet it's this very far away place that not many people are connected to. So VR is that immersive that it's like bringing it to your doorstep. And the impacts are incredible. We've had people reach out to us where their 8-year-old's gone and seen it recently, and then he's painted his entire bedroom mural in penguins. We've had a police officer reach out. He went and collected 200 million litres of rubbish to raise money for the Antarctic Marathon. Like, the sorts of outcomes that we still get bombarded with all the time are just phenomenal. So you can see that they're not just a piece of entertainment. It's also an experience that has a long, profound, lasting impact on people. And, I mean, as a filmmaker, that's the best feeling in the world.
Of course. And it becomes commercially viable production and everything. It's all positive, right? It's all positive on so many levels.
Yeah, absolutely.
Breege, thank you so much for joining me. Really enjoyed catching up with you and talking about all the different 360 projects you're working on. When we last spoke, which is, I think it was during lockdown. Mm. So have you seen things progress in this space significantly since that point?
Yeah, we have. I mean, COVID definitely saw an uptick in VR headset sales. And also, I think we ran the Antarctica experience right in the middle of lockdown in New Zealand, and it was their most successful month. If anything, this sort of content where it can take people to places they wouldn't otherwise get to go to, that's only expanded. And there's nothing like that than in a 360 3D environment. So I only see it going exponentially more up in the future.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think the Apple headset, they tend to change and create markets when they launch products. When you talked about, you know, the smartwatch market, and they created a whole new market. I can see very much, you know, that this might be the same. So big opportunities for filmmakers all around the world to create some amazing interactive experiences. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So my next guest on this week's show, looking at immersive content and the future of immersive content, is Nina Diamond, who is executive producer at New York's The Metropolitan Museum of Art. How are you doing, Nina? Lovely to meet you.
I'm great. It's nice to see you, Justin.
First of all, if those of us who haven't been to New York and been to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, tell us a little bit about the museum and the sort of exhibits that people can enjoy over there.
Sure. I'm an executive producer at the Met, as you suggested, and while that informs my point of view, I'm definitely not speaking for the organization in any official capacity, but certainly the museum welcomes pre-pandemic 7.5 million people a year on foot and many, many, many more online. So it's a wonderful hub in the city and an incredible collection that is popular both locally with locals and with tourists who come from all over the world. But I think one thing we've learned certainly during COVID is the power of a global audience. So that's a big part of the work that we do in digital, is to share stories about the collection and the work being done at the Met with a wider audience.
Yes, of course. And obviously, you know, it's one of the great museums known around the world. And it's really fascinating that you have a role looking at digital and looking at ways to expand the reach, but also presumably expand the experience of people that are interacting with the museum. We just spoke to Breege from White Spark Pictures about the amazing rollout of her VR films and the way that she's starting to collaborate with museums in Australia and also the Royal Institution in London to not only bring her films to a wider audience, but also to develop new revenue streams for museums. In many cases, for a content producer, that opens up a new opportunity, new revenue stream, a new way of doing things. So tell me a little bit about how you're looking at digital and immersive content from your role, and what opportunities do you see in the future for working in this space?
It is really an exciting moment in this space. And I think for me, I have an art history background, but for many years now have been working in digital media and making media for the public. So becoming bilingual with tech as well. And I think I'm fascinated by what it can do to bring art and culture alive for people and have been following the developments for years. But I think at the Met, I've had an opportunity to work with colleagues to use emerging tech in a variety of interesting ways over the years. We've made 360-degree videos of some of our iconic spaces using moving camera shots. We've launched the first immersive binaural audio experience that had like 40 tracks of sound. We've worked in VR. Recently, we had a project called Chroma AR, which is an experience that allows smartphone users to virtually create an ancient Greek sculpture of a Sphinx in full color in their own space and to compare sort of what it looked like in its original state, which was highly colorful, with what it looks like now when the pigments have come off of it, and to learn about the scientific background of that and so on. So we've had a number of opportunities to explore immersive tech projects at the Met, but I'm also just really interested in what I see happening with museums and cultural institutions now to not only have experiences on site like this, but to have experiences that can travel and people engaging with them in cities around the world. And when I was in Europe recently, really interested to meet with makers who are doing untethered VR experiences, large-scale projections. You know, it's a fantastic opportunity to tell these stories about art and culture in new ways for new audiences and to have them be mobile.
When you're talking about the digital products that you've developed and worked with over the last few years, have you worked in VR specifically before? And is it something that you see as being a real opportunity going forward for you as a museum?
Well, it's interesting. I think VR, it's a space that has changed tremendously in the last 5 years. And so I've been really interested to see some of the very recent developments about what's possible, especially with pass-through and untethered experiences. But the Met is such a large institution with so much foot traffic that it hasn't been as practical a place to have kind of pop-ups or to have people using headsets on site as it has been that I've seen at smaller institutions. That's not to say there wouldn't be a potential for it in the future, I don't think. It's just the museum space itself isn't conducive to it. We have created projects that can be seen in that environment at home, but we haven't presented them on site.
Is it something that you're considering moving into in the future, do you think? I mean, do you see an opportunity, as I said earlier, not only to enrich experience of people visiting the Met, but also the opportunity for people to visit remotely as well?
From my experience, what's important is to think about the stories that you're trying to tell first, and then figure out the tech that is the best platform for that or the best vehicle for that storytelling. And I think one of the things that's fascinating about immersive experiences in general, whatever platform they're on, is that they're combating a kind of distraction that's now endemic in our culture. We are hyper connected, and we have sort of a love-hate relationship to that state of being. So we, on the one hand, want to be connected all the time, and on the other hand, we're longing for something peaceful, contemplative, connecting us. And I think what I'm really interested in is museums, they were traditionally a place that people went as destinations for all kinds of experiences, but they now have the opportunity to evolve and change. And I think tech has a role to play in that, but it needs to stay aligned with the values that an institution cares about. And for me personally, I'm kind of agnostic on the tech unless it achieves that. This is why narrative and story are so important, and that tech it's more important than just being used for spectacle. But it's really got to have meaning, and it has to have a narrative thread in order to bring you there.
And that's something that traditionally TV producers and content producers are experts in is telling those stories. So that's why it's such a fascinating potential opportunity to tell new stories in new types of tech that maybe have never been told. So I think that's, you know, it's a really interesting potential for the future. Just coming back to something you said earlier on about the development over the last 5 years of VR, how do you see that has played out? Is it more a case of more impressive, higher definition, or is it just you think it's becoming more mainstream? Can you just tell us a little bit about your thinking of how it's developed over the last 5 years and why maybe now we're starting to meet a bit of a point where this can really go mainstream?
I think that VR has always been touted as having opportunities for empathy. It's unusual in its ability to immerse us. And what I find interesting about it is as the tech evolves, as pass-through becomes more sophisticated and other sort of tricks, some things remain constant and some elements of storytelling still remain really relevant, old-fashioned ones. And what I'm thinking of in particular is the engagement of five senses. I think in a way, immersives, whether it's in VR or whether it's in these huge environments where, you know, ticketed events where you go into large spaces with sound and light projection, part of what is fascinating to me about them is that they are new rituals for a multi-generational audience. And our culture has lost a lot of sense of ritual, and people are craving experiences that they can have together that are uplifting and transcendent. And what I find really interesting about the spaces is how the opportunity exists to explore them, to have more uplifting and meaningful experiences in them rather than just sound and light. And maybe this has been beginning in VR first and is now happening on a larger scale, especially post-COVID when we can do this. But you think about religions across time, cathedrals were immersive experiences, mosques, temples, indigenous people, like the rituals involving five senses have always been a part of global culture. And art helps to facilitate that. So I think when I think about what's possible for museums and VR or any of these immersives, it's to figure out how to tell stories in a way that are uplifting and sharing culture in a fresh environment.
And we're seeing in the coming months the launch of the Apple's new headset, VR headset, that we were talking to Bridge about earlier on today, which she felt is almost going to be this tipping point, this, you know, real opportunity for VR to go mainstream. And it's not only going to be used for VR, it's obviously lots of AR and other experiences, more of a sort of a daytime work experiences as well as actually enjoyment and entertainment. So are you looking at the launch of the Apple headset as another sort of staging point in this journey of wider acceptance of VR?
Sure. I think the challenge with VR has typically been one of access, right? And so I think this headset it'll be interesting to see what happens with it. And there's, I think, a lot of creative work being done to create environments to discover AR, like going to a film festival and trying out a few is one way. You're not really talking about a large scale market for that. And I'm thinking that the sector, I'm not going to say it's in its infancy, and maybe it's not even a toddler. It's not clumsy, but I think you have to compare it with something like television. And I'm thinking before World War II, only a few thousand homes in the U.S. had televisions. By 1955, about half of U.S. households had a television. Now, when you look at the TV market, it's incredibly segmented, it's highly sophisticated, and all the storytelling has become more sophisticated too. So I think the same is going to happen with VR, that kind of market segmentation, that kind of targeted content. And there will also be a lot of opportunity for experimentation with the offer and where the content is consumed. I mean, I think museums are one option, but you also see things happening like in shopping malls, and there's a lot of potential there. And I think we see even more of it happening in Asia. I was talking with colleagues in France recently about them bringing an immersive experience from France to Asia, and the market there, so many of the general public have headsets at home that they really weren't that interested in going to a destination space to do VR. That was not what was meaningful to them. And I think it's interesting to us because I think in America, the number of people who have VR headsets at home and who are actively using them for fun or is a smaller number than we're seeing in Asia. So yes, incredible opportunity, but I also think we'll probably see this sector learning how to walk and then run over time. And I certainly don't think we're there yet. So the other thing, Justin, is in addition to content, which obviously as a content creator is super close to my heart, are some other issues that have to do with interactivity and agency. I think the political climate right now is significant. People want to be active participants. They don't want to just be consumers of culture or entertainment. And as a content creator, that's really interesting to me because you want to be a part of shaping it and you also want to invite people in. As I see VR, there's one of the places that's most interesting is the opportunity that's growing for personalization of that experience. And whether that's growth of, you know, the sophistication of haptics that allow people to actively engage, or whether it's personalization. So those things I think are things I'm going to really be looking at that I think are super exciting, because at the end of the day, I think of it like what I call pebbles in the pocket. What do you leave people with afterwards? What do you leave them with when they leave? What remains in their pocket for them to hang on to later? You know, in the gaming world, they call this game feeling, like that you want to come back to something because it makes you feel a certain way. And in the case of an art museum, what is the feeling we're cultivating for our visitors, whether they're on site, online, whether it's in a VR experience or others? In the case of an art museum, the game feeling that you're going for is tethered to goals that are sort of lofty. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But I just think it's beyond just content. It's also about the experience and how it's rolled out and how the participants are a part of making it and creating it. I don't know. For me, that's a super interesting segment.
It's all about the content. It's all about the storytelling and the ability to craft amazing stories, which I'm sure you will be doing at some point in the future, Nina, with your incredible collection over at the Met. But thank you so much for joining us this week. Really enjoyed chatting with you, and good luck with everything at the Met.
Thanks so much. And thanks for having me.
My next guest on this week's show is Tom Bowers, founder of Hypothesis Media. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Hi, Justin. Yeah, very well. Thank you very much. Good to be here. Good to talk to you today.
Yeah, you too. Where are you talking to us from today, Tom?
In the immediate sense, I'm in a TARDIS-like box in Hastings. Best place for soundproofing, I've found in this building. But yeah, we're down on the south coast. It's absolutely pouring today. So whilst it's meant to be sunny at the seaside, it certainly isn't today.
Okay. All right. Well, much of a TV industry out there, Tom, is much of a sort of an outpost of the TV industry in the UK?
Well, you might not be aware of this, but the television was actually invented in Hastings. And next year is the 100th year anniversary of when the television was created. So we are looking to sort of help input into this. They're potentially doing a festival down in Hastings to celebrate that. But on a general day to day, there isn't much sort of punctuation around this area being sort of the birthplace of television, even though every time I drive past the sign as I go into the area, it's like Hastings and St. Leonard's, the birthplace of television. And I'm like, it's prodding me to sort of help with that situation. So hopefully next year we're going to input into that and sort of turn that around and create it into a bit more of a mecca for television in general.
All right. Well, that'd be interesting. It's always a good opportunity to go down to the South Coast and Hastings and all of that.
Indeed.
So you're talking there about the past of, 100 years of television, but this week's show is very much about the future and new technologies. Tell us about Hypothesis Media and what you do.
So I started my career in television a good 25 years ago, and I was quite fortunate really that I started working on traditional television shows, things like Big Brother and Fame Academy and sort of reality shows, just at the time when kind of mobile technology was coming through the ranks. You know, people had their Nokia 3210s and were able to text for the first time, and it became a thing and an interest around, well, how can we kind of harbour that and bring it into television shows? So we launched a SMS to screen service, something very, very simple, on Big Brother, on the live feed, to sort of get people's opinion of what was happening on the live show. And I was sort of managing that as it came through, as we launched it live on a sort of lower third ticker on the screen. And there was thousands upon thousands of messages coming in real time. And I was just like, there's something in this. There's something in this whole interactive television game. So from that moment on, I kind of niched myself down the kind of more interactive route, knowing that technology was only going to improve. Saw the desire of audiences and fans wanting to have their opinion and get involved, changing outcomes of TV shows. But there wasn't really many people at that time that understood the intersection between live television editorially and also the technology and how that can work together to produce new shows and new elements within shows. So worked at major broadcasters, Channel 5, Channel 4, Sky, in various different roles around interactivity. And then fast forward now to 2017, and I set up my own interactive consultancy, which is Hypothesis Media, which we specialise in fan engagement and visual innovation across the broadcast industry. And we basically work with the best of breed technology and content partners to move the industry forward. We act as kind of like the glue between the two. So obviously our ability to understand what is traditional television and how to make television, plus being able to add these new elements in a way that makes sense to the industry, using our industry knowledge. And we act as that kind of handholder experts in the industry to sort of bring those elements to new TV shows or enhancing existing ones. Yeah, we're acting in a bit of a niche space, really, but it's the timing is really exciting at the moment, given all of the developments that are happening in the industry with AI and mixed reality, virtual production, obviously the changes that are happening around social media and Twitter turning to X and fan engagement from that perspective. So it's a really exciting time. So yeah, that's the kind of journey of Hypothesis, really.
Coming back to a key term that you used was TV.
Yep.
In the sense that, you know, you're focused literally on the TV in the corner, which in a traditional sense, and seeing how you can build viewer engagement and innovations around the traditional linear TV show, essentially.
Yep.
And that's very different from what we were talking to Breej about, which is really interesting. And I think a lot of people, you know, just focus on the future just being in a sort of a different 3D space, but it'd be really interesting for us to learn a little bit more about, you know, what the future is going to be for linear as well and what these new technologies can do. Tell us a little bit about your past and present clients then, Tom. Give us a little bit of sense of what else you've done in the years since you were doing the text-to-screen stuff. And interesting, I suppose, that back then there was a pretty strong business model, wasn't there, when it was the text-to-screen stuff that created somewhat of a, you know, call in to shows and interaction that way. There was a real revenue stream, but I guess that's not so much the case anymore.
No, I mean, back in the early part of sort of when interactivity was of interest to TV shows, it was not only the editorial control or input that audiences could have to the show, but also from a commercial broadcaster perspective was what's the, you know, the extra monetary streams that could come in from this. We, you know, additional upsells, ringtones around the shows that they were engaging with was a big thing at the time, using premium rate. And then obviously that evolved into sort of voting for your favourite winners on things like The X Factor and Pop Idol, done at a premium rate and done in new innovative ways, whether it be through SMS or kind of via apps, by app bundles. We did a project with Got a Sky with a show called Must Be the Music, where you could download an app bundle of votes that you could use across the series and how that could be monetized for the broadcaster. So there's lots of kind of different new elements that we're trialing and erroring at the time around how this interactivity could benefit the shows editorially as well as commercially. So we worked on lots of different big brand stuff around kind of interactivity across the last 10 years, predominantly. Namely, we worked on the Brit Awards for the first ever global interactive social vote. So the audiences at home could vote via Twitter to decide live on the outcome of a vote on an award. So we worked with a technology company that harnessed all of the sort of social votes and then delivered that live to the live production team, which would then affect, obviously, the live editorial of the show. So there was lots of sensitivities around that. It was a well-known brand. And us kind of managing that with our understanding of live television production, sort of having produced shows myself in the past. So embedding that with the understanding of where these interactive elements need to go in and how the vote needs to be delivered in a time-sensitive environment. So that was a brilliant experience of how those two worlds could collide and work really well in terms of a live television entertainment show. We also worked on the first ever live viewer engagement gamification show, which was a show called Million Pound Drop with Davina McCall on Channel 4. Going back a bit now, but it's probably the first show where you had sort of interactive gameplay integrated into the live TV show. And Davina would kind of name check people that were doing particularly well on a certain question. And there'll be graphics on screen to say who was doing well, whether it was men or women and which part of the country they were from. So it was a real upgrade in terms of interactivity to kind of bring personalization of people playing at home into a live show. And then that having some kind of impact on the show editorially, because I think I can't remember exactly how it kind of manifested, but I think it was like the top 100 people that played online then had the opportunity to play in the studio next week. So it was that kind of closing that gap up between audiences at home and being able to be active participants in the show itself. So it created a nice crossover. And probably most recently, this came more prevalent during the pandemic. We worked on Ant and the Dec Saturday Night Takeaway with the virtual interactive audience, which was solving a problem at the time that obviously TV shows couldn't have any live audiences due to COVID. And we came up with a solution to basically bring audiences in a way where it was delivered on screens. People were interacting via a bespoke platform, which was a very lean forward interactive experience where audiences could be asked questions during the live show. They were greeted by a member of the production team when they came in to the broadcast, and then they could interact one-to-one with Ant and Dec if they were selected on screen to sort of partake in some of the games that they're well known for on the studio show. So very much an interactive version of how the audience usually participate in the show to sort of help with getting them through the pandemic, which could have been taken forward to sort of a hybrid version of audiences at home playing as well, but they decided to not move ahead with that. Most recently, we're really focusing on sort of live mixed reality, because virtual production is a big buzzword across the industry in general, given our experiences and how we can sort of help handhold traditional production teams and producers to success in this area and kind of put it in language that they understand. And also looking at the areas across the industry that sort of potentially need help with extra monetization due to the proliferation of sort of extra streaming services and there not being enough commissioning budgets available at the moment. Likewise, with the dropping advertising revenues, we see lots of live mixed reality as a solution to that problem. And given audiences at home in terms of where they watch television in a very comfortable manner on their settees at home, it's a really great way for the future of mixed reality and, you know, the benefits, particularly like things like the Vision Pro headset coming out from Apple, to introduce the benefits of what mixed reality and virtual production can do in an environment that people feel comfortable and safe with. Because I think there's a bit of a mismatch at the moment in terms of what the technology can do in terms of one user interactivity with a headset at home, you know, the Vision Pro headset, but they're not really understanding from a user perspective, what does the content do? How do I get the benefits from that? And I think the TV has got a big part to play in the education of how people can use these different extra content features in a way that's going to benefit their lives. So we're introducing it in ways using, you know, in the advertising space, particularly around live sporting programs. And looking to sort of how they've kind of executed it in the US through our partner network to kind of bring that over here, introduce it in a way that's going to be paid for by a brand because it's around the advertising space, but it's also so people can see how sophisticated the graphics are on screen overlaid onto the live game. And then they can sort of go, oh, this looks amazing. Where's this, you know, how does this work? And that forces them to ask questions and see the benefits of virtual production and live mixed reality. And then they'll have a bit better understanding as they're sort of seeing this on screen to create water cooler moments, and then have discussions with their friends and their family about what they've seen on telly that they've never seen in such a way before. So it's introducing it in a way that feels comfortable for them. And I think the TV environment is the best forum to be able to do that, to kind of educate, which ultimately is what TV is there to do, to educate and entertain. So, yeah, it's a really exciting time to sort of bring the two worlds together. But, you know, and there's problems to solve and differences between the US and the UK due to different Ofcom regulations and ASA guidelines and whatnot. And we're sort of navigating through those with the individual broadcasters and the different nuances they have between them. But it's a really, really exciting time particularly for virtual and sort of where we sit as an organisation to sort of help broadcasters and set them up for success in this space.
That's really interesting because, you know, you talked about, you know, in the past, perhaps the audience interactivity on linear TV has been much more around kind of game show type formats and possibly less around, you know, sport, for example, and different types of live broadcast. But just before we talk a little bit more about that, tell us what you mean by mixed reality. And you mentioned the Apple headsets, and that's something that, you know, that Breege and I spoke about earlier on in the show, which was going to be certainly a game changer from her perspective. Are we talking here about an experience that you can only have with a headset when you talk about live broadcast mixed reality?
No, absolutely not. So there's no technology or hardware that's needed from the user perspective, which is why I think being able to showcase it using the forum of the television to be able to show the level of content and sophistication of graphics with mixed reality on live TV production is the way to educate audiences without them having to part with thousands of pounds for a new piece of hardware, which they don't know what the benefits are of yet. So imagine just sitting at home, you're watching the Champions League or you know, a basketball game or Wimbledon or something sort of sporting relating that's live. And then around that content, you get through the ability of using people like some of our partners like Pixotope, which is a big VR software company that does live broadcast mixed reality graphics or enables that to happen, leveraging Unreal Engine graphics, which obviously is big in the sort of gaming community. And for gamers alike, they're sort of synonymous with them and they understand kind of the level of photorealistic graphics that can be achieved with Unreal Engine. Harnessing the power of those graphics and then being able to overlay them onto live broadcast cameras using tracking technology. So it looks like that those graphics are actually on the pitch, on the call, or in the arena, whether it be a character animation or some sophisticated graphics that kind of give stats information. It could be a anniversary experience, potentially like, you know, celebratory 100 years of a certain institution. A way of celebrating in a way that looks visually very, very different, but leveraging the infrastructure that's already in place from a broadcast production perspective. So the cameras that are all around the stadium or the event, having these mixed reality trackers on the cameras. So whenever the director takes to those different cameras, the graphics where the camera's pointing to, it looks like that graphics will be in that frame in the right position. So wherever you cut to, the graphics engine basically works out, oh, okay, we've gone to camera 5 and it's the right side of the pitch. So that animation needs to be in a certain position that replicates where that camera is pointing to. So it's all very sophisticated, all literally ties in over the top of the existing camera infrastructure that you've already got there. And the audiences at home, it makes them question, God, is that actually there on the pitch happening? You know, and it's blending those two worlds of digital and physical.
Just so I can envisage what this might look like. So, for example, a lot of the moving cameras, like the spider cams or even cameras that are on drones that you often see around major sporting events now. So if you, to take your example of a Champions League match, if it was the final, for example, you could have at halftime a giant Champions League trophy, hundreds of feet high, you know, exploding or just revolving or whatever. You're looking at that on your TV screen from various different points in the stadium, and essentially on your TV it looks like it's really there.
Absolutely, yeah, that's a great summary. Creatively, it could be anything. We've done things in the US with the Carolina Panthers, which is their mascot, and the panther sort of runs around the stadium sort of swiping at the attendees in the venue. Obviously, the attendees in the venue don't get to see it like the viewers at home. They can see it on screens themselves. We can put the same feed into the return feed into the screens in the venue, so they get to see it. Obviously, not in the same way that people at home are seeing it on the live broadcast feed. But it's a way of adding a layer that looks like a digital layer that looks like it's actually there. And obviously, for brands and advertisers, it's a new way to get their brand seen by thousands of people at sort of big destination sporting events. I mean, it could be entertainment events, but predominantly it's in America. It tends to be sort of big sporting events where there's lots of viewers. To be able to do this very exciting, catalytic experience that audiences wouldn't have seen before,
right,
using mixed reality.
So essentially, from a commercial broadcaster's perspective, then, you know, you go to an ad break at halftime during the match, and actually you can come back as a broadcaster. You then have the opportunity to sell more advertising within the actual editorial of the show. If there is, as you say, a panther or a car driving around the middle of the pitch at halftime, that can be essentially branded content within the editorial of the show.
Well, this is the exciting thing, Justin. I think this, given the reduction of ad spend in TV advertising, and, you know, that's due to various different reasons, but the proliferation of different streaming services, which means that there's, you know, less money in TV advertising like there used to be across the main five linear broadcasters. This is a way that you could basically rewrite how, but not around all content, but certain sort of headline destination TV, live TV content, how ads are bought to people. So instead of having the traditional ad slot where there's four or five different 30-second pre-recorded ads, you literally could have a bleed over from the live content into a ad spot that looks like it's part of the editorial. Now, there are challenges there, you know, differences between the US and UK in terms of regulation around audiences being notified that what they're seeing is actually an ad. And there's some challenges we're working with various different major broadcasters in the UK to overcome those. But I think it's going to really enable a different opportunity for broadcast advertisers to be able to do something new and innovative, which is going to attract a premium to broadcasters, which will then help top up the ailing commissioning pots that they've got in other areas to help supplement that. So it's solving a lot of problems around how ads can be showcased. Another area which I think is really, really important is because it bolts onto the infrastructure of the live show, it actually upskills a lot of the traditional TV teams in virtual production. So they get exposed to how this actually works, given this is going to be more into the future of television production in general. The whole new area of virtual production is a big umbrella, of which mixed reality is a small part of that. But it upskills them all because they're exposed to the features, the benefits, how the camera tracking works. The directors then see how that works in conjunction with their traditional shots. It gives producers new ideas of how they can feed that into new format ideas and into that kind of content creation pot. Go, oh, that didn't know that element was possible with virtual production, mixed reality. There's a format potentially in that. And they go away and work on that. We're starting off with working with advertisers to introduce it into the market. Actually, there's loads of benefits for the broadcast industry in terms of transformation that it's going to do to sort of introduce virtual production into the DNA of kind of operation in general. So there's lots of different exciting areas that it's really, really benefiting, as well as the kind of change in the advertising commercial ad break potentially, and changing that around live content initially. So it's a very, very exciting time.
Well, I can imagine the ears of broadcasters will be pricking up when they're hearing further opportunities to sell more space within the editorial of the show. That's really interesting. As a consultant, you're essentially responsible for selling the idea and then bringing the production partners together to realise that, essentially.
We're looking for the opportunities for the broadcasters to innovate for fans and to give more immersive content and be ahead of the game compared to their competitors. We don't want this to be a one-trick pony. We want them to feel like that this is providing a repeatable blueprint for them as a business to be able to offer this up time and time again once they've got the understanding of how the infrastructure works and What we've done is we've prevented a united front of end-to-end partners that are best of breed in our view, that we've hand-selected through a big R&D process, you know, working with people, big players in the US like the Famous Group, Pixotope here in the UK, and various delivery partners that we've got aligned that have worked in the TV industry already in live sporting and entertainment events, bringing them all together to say, guys, if you want to do this and achieve this, we will basically give you the full infrastructure from the creative design, the ideation, the software, right through to the live delivery that can work with the existing production teams to set you up for complete success. So taking all that pain away for them to kind of not just present the idea of how it could work creatively, but also we've got the united front to be able to work with them and they can plug straight into that and set them up for complete success. So we want to make it as easy as possible because we understand this is a new area, but we also know that whilst this is happening, people have still got their traditional jobs to be getting on with. They've still got to, you know, produce a live sporting event and having been exposed to working in live television before, that's a very hard task to do. So we want to do it in a way that they feel like, oh, this is not overtaking what we're currently doing. Producing the live content, you know, on a live sporting match or entertainment show is very, very hard work. But we want to do it in a way that they don't feel threatened. You know, we've got the understanding of how live TV works, but we also know how we can make it slot in and make it provide that overlap to this, for this new area of television that is upon us.
Now, it's very exciting stuff. I've been thinking while you've been speaking there, you know, opportunities around Formula One and thinking,
oh, totally.
The Goodyear blimp could see a return in virtual form and all these sort of treatments that that could work really well. What's your next project coming up where you're implementing this sort of technology?
Well, we're talking with a lot of different rights holders in the sporting arena because whilst we're getting broadcasters involved, and for them to understand the opportunities from them at a local level, we also want to make sure that from a sporting perspective specifically, they understand that if they, you know, if, as a rights holder, if they can get involved at that level and bolt it into part of their broadcast that goes global, then everybody can kind of see these kind of activations at the source point of the broadcast. We are having some very exciting conversations as we speak about how these some of these sports rights holders can, as part of the walk on onto the pitch or half time, there'd be like, you know, the Super Bowl halftime show, there could be a mixed reality performance that audiences everywhere around the globe will see. It's, it'll be like a specific performance using mixed reality and potentially other live performers. So it's introducing the world, we hope, to sort of see the benefits of this. Not only from an advertising perspective, and then advertising obviously pays for this technology creative initially because it is quite expensive to implement. But ultimately, we want to get it under the skin of as many people as possible from both a broadcaster and fan perspective. They go, oh, I want to see more of that. I want to, you know, potentially see the next iteration of the story or the narrative that can potentially form on each match or each game.
Tom, really, really fascinating to hear what you're doing with live broadcast mixed reality where you don't need the glasses.
Nope.
To give people some ideas. I'll put a link in the episode description to some of the examples that you've been talking about there so people can get an idea and visualize it.
Great.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Tom. All the best with Hypothesis and good luck with this next generation of mixed reality.
Thanks, Justin. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's about it for this season of Telecast. Thanks as always for sticking with us. I hope you enjoyed it. If you've got any suggestions for guests or topics for season 7, just drop me a line on LinkedIn. This week's Telecast was edited by Ian Chambers and recorded in London. We'll be back again in September as the industry gears up for the all-important Q4. Until then, have a great summer and stay safe.